Craig Tyndale, private investor and writer of the C. Tyndale Substack. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Craig, you write quite a lot and about basically the way to deconstruct what's happening in the world right now. And I always enjoy getting to, you know, dig into your articles, or let's say being forced to really dig into them when I do the research for interviews like this. But why do you see the current era as one of a, let's say, domino type event that leads to a civilizational renewal?
I guess what we've got is mankind's propensity to make models of things and then start believing the territory is the map they made. You know, it's we've got a long history of manias and things that we do as a group, and I think, you know, through evolution, we stuck together because that was an evolutionary impulse. You know, if you're under siege, having 12 different ideas about how to protect yourself and how to offset the siege was non-functional. So we became usefully group thinking, and we would think together and be loyal to each other's ideas. And we've entered a more complex world. So, you know, we've got a variety of models that everybody know. We've got, you know, the FOMC models or the central banking models that we use right across the world. And we've become, I guess, entrained to the idea that these models are useful and the right models. And, you know, in most cases, independent, they think that we're managing society outside the politicians' grasp. But the models really just model what the model makers can see. And, you know, in the case of central banking, they can't see much. They can see lagging price signals. They can see information about what they choose to make inflation to be, but that's a model in itself. And so what happens is the models don't notice the territory. And in this case, the territory is the industrial system, the ability to make things and remain independent and to preserve liberty, etc., because remaining independent and preserving liberty, you know, relies on the ability to make things and to be, you know, independent to some in many respects, or at least contingently, you know, interdependent. That is, they rely on us for as much stuff as we rely on them. You know, and you know, traditionally we did this among allies, but we didn't do it across empires. So, you know, the British Empire didn't rely on the Ottoman Empire, for instance. You know, they had independent means. And through globalization and the model that price efficiency is, I guess, the most efficient way of doing things, that is the price, if it's cheaper in China to make iPhones, let's make them in China. Let's not worry about our own independence, our own ability to sustain an economy. That must be efficient. And in many ways, it's kind of like a delusional model. And I don't say delusional in the mental sense. I say delusional in the sense that it only measures the territory partially. And then when, you know, the territory kind of comes up and the hard edges of the territory come up to surprise us, people, you know, scratch their heads and say, well, we thought this is how things worked. And that's kind of the cycle that we follow. We follow a similar one with climate change. You know, we have a model, I think, you know, there's been a lot of media on, we've moved from 8.5 to 7. And so we're taking a lower view of what CO2 will be emitted and how much that will affect the environment. And it's only a small model, you know, it's a model that moves the potential, externalities, you know, the potential coupled, tipping points. It moves them out, so as not to confuse the model. And so we don't get a realistic view of, you know, for instance, we've got a lot of heat coming in the moment for El Nino, and the waters, the ocean's heating up a lot. But, you know, we don't take into account the deoxygenization that that's occurred because we move to open loop scrubbers rather than sending the sulfur up into the atmosphere. And when we stopped putting the sulfur in the atmosphere because we regulated it out, we didn't take into account the lack of clouds that would occur. Now we've got satellite information that says that we've got less clouds than we had 10 years ago. And that's been caused by regulation. And we're putting that sulfur, the previous aerosol that went into into cloud making and pollution, I'll give you that. We're putting it into the ocean, and that that lowers the oxygen in the ocean. It lowers the plankton in the ocean because we're putting a whole bunch of pollution into the ocean. And so when we've got less clouds and this heat comes in, the heat goes much deeper because, you know, obviously plankton is like a thermal layer. If you've got lots of plankton, when the sun comes in, the heat doesn't go as deep. And so, you know, these are things, you know, we can understand the systems involved in making a cake. People just say they don't understand system dynamics. And if you've made a cake, you understand system dynamics. You have a lot of inputs. You have to put them in at the right in the right process at the right time, and you know you've got to heat the temperature up to a certain extent. And you know if you do the system dynamics properly, you end up with an edible or hopefully a much nicer to eat cake. And that's what kind of goes into the climate. But we do things, you know, at even a more simple system than we do with climate. And so it doesn't make any sense. These models we have don't tell us what the territory could be. You know, I use the example of the FOMC and the central banks. It never told us the territory might be that when we deindustrialize completely, we may in fact, lose our liberty and freedom and impair our ability to act as, you know, independent actors as foreign countries, etc., like that. The same goes with climate. We have a limited view of what the model looks like, and we believe that limited view. And now the edges of that model, the territory, is coming up to poke us in the ribs, and they're quite consequential. And you can think of these models right across society. The model we had with just-in-time manufacturing, you know, made sense to everyone at the time. You know,
Before we move on to the just-in-time inventories, why do you think it is that we can't, let's say, understand the climate models? Is it because the scientists that build the models make it so complex that the average person doesn't feel like they can't understand it? Or, you know, like, why is that not a more questioned piece of quote-unquote science?
Because I think they're necessarily complex. You know, let's face it, a global climate system is complex. And so in order to represent it, it's quite a challenging thing from a science point of view. I think people's ability to absorb complex models is kind of limited. You know, we have a society that evolved to, you know, with artisans and guilds and things like that to act as a village, and now we're asking large populations to understand complex systems. And you know, there weren't that many complex systems before. We just evolved inside our own bubble, so to speak, wherever that bubble was. So it's difficult, and I think it's also difficult because there's a lot of specialization. you know, when I talk to people about hydrology and I talk to people about aerosol science for climate, and then you talk to people about another specialization, for instance, oceans, we've got very gifted people in each of those specializations, but they don't go across the margins. And so you've got kind of islands of understanding where what we need is an integrated viewpoint. We don't get that integrated viewpoint because the aerosol expert is not an oceanographer, and the oceanographer is not a specialist in plankton, and you know, the acidification specialist is a specialist in acidification, but not a specialist in anything else. So I think it's, you know, and we do that across everything. So, you know, you look at, you know, we'll go back to that example of central banking. You know, who understands the FOMC models? Almost nobody. So it's easy to say the central bank should be independent because none of the politicians and none of the people understand what the central bank's doing. And, you know, what is the finer tuning of what the central bank's doing? What are they causing to happen in the society? So the democracy can't have a say because the democracy, frankly, doesn't understand what the central bank's doing. And it's not explicit. You know, nobody in the last 30 years understood that we were going to deindustrialize. You know, we knew it to some extent because we used to say, well, you know, the unions are costing too much money, we have to do it overseas. But nobody really understood inside the democracy what the consequences were. And so you get that kind of islanding and that specialization and that inability for the broad public to understand what they're talking about anyway. And you've got this, you know, these are not the only two subjects we're using as examples, but there's 100 examples like this. And everyone's trying to cope with, you know, their own kind of island of interest, so to speak. You know, I've got some really good friends who are environmentalists, and they are trying to understand the world from an environmental point of view. And then their environmental political parties start talking about gender, and they don't know what they think. You know, the left and the green left and the socialist left and the kind of gender left have all kind of merged into this confusing little substack of different ideas, and most people aren't coping. And who's to blame them? You know, I find it confusing enough as it is. So I think it's our natures. You know, you take us back to the village. We didn't have all this complexity to deal with. You know, like I did some ancestral research on my grandmother, who was kind of shipped out here by the British to look after some Irish orphans, you know, during the 1850s. And she, my guess is, after doing the research on her, is she probably never went anywhere for the first 23 years of her life. And that was probably normal in Ireland at the time, that, you know, they'd work, they'd worry about getting the bread baked, and they'd worry about getting the toothache fixed and all this kind of stuff. But they didn't have out of world issues. You know, they occasionally read a newspaper about some foreign war. So we haven't got the skill base to do it. We haven't got the kind of cultural mores to understand how to process this, and now we're trying to process it, and we're getting confused, and that's not surprising.
Craig, do you think that going back to the idea of the FOMC model, for example, it seems to me that the amount of fractional reserve borrowing or printing that we've done seems to have really borrowed from the future. Is that one of the main, let's say, drivers of what got us into this situation.
Yeah. It's, you know, whenever you borrow money, you're really taking earnings from the future and accounting for them, you know. So you're saying, I'm going to spend this dollar now and I'm going to pay for it in the future. And this dollar now hopefully benefits the people in the future, or it may not. But we've done it, you know, fairly narrowly along consumption lines. You know, the economists in the FOMC and the central banks have decided that consumption is the god of the deity of our economy, and so we'll and employment, and we'll follow employment and consumption until we get I guess a tail that emerges that, you know, kind of defeats all that idea that you can't consume forever, you can't borrow forever, and you because it will eventually impact employment, and will eventually impact the kind of viability of your economy and the freedom of the people that are within that economy. So it's kind of strange ideas that we don't look forward. So, you know, you mentioned not looking forward, you know, we're going to be paying for these extravagances in the future because we're borrowing now and we're going to pay it back in the future. But we don't look forward in the greater sense. We don't look forward in, you know, if we keep doing this, this is the consequences to us, let alone our children. Because, you know, a lot of, you know, the what's happening now is the consequences to the people who actually enacted it. It's not even our children in this case. You know, we're putting pressure on ourselves because of this, the kind of the delusions we had back in the 90s and the 2000s, that price efficiency was more important than sovereignty. And we didn't think of it that way, but that's what we relatively decided.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the complexity of these just-in-time inventory models obviously is, you know, coming under great threat right now. Do you think that it's, you know, the combination of recency bias and the idea of not looking forward enough as to building redundancies into our own systems or you know, domestic production in order to account for something like the Strait of Hormuz closing?
Yeah, I just don't think that any of our systems, like, we go off on kind of a branch and then we fail to look back. So that, you know, the branch was efficiency, and the branch was, you know, price was the signal of efficiency. And, you know, a natural, I guess, derivative of that is that just-in-time manufacturing was a derivative of efficiency as well. You know, if we don't have to waste all that inventory sitting on shelves, that's going to be more effective, and that's going to be higher shareholder value. So let's become more efficient, more efficient, more efficient. And you know, it's like blinkers on. You put blinkers on a horse, they only focus on what's ahead of them, and that's what we've done. Mm-hmm. But we've done that in a variety of different areas. We don't really look forward to, you know, we kind of adopt ideas without first analyzing or perceiving what are the system's effects down the track. And to some extent, we don't care because we're, you know, people talk about companies just being worried about the next quarter. I think human beings do that to a certain extent as well. You know, what are we worried about? We're worried about what happens in 3 months. What are we worried about? You know, our whole demeanor focuses on the here and now, and doesn't look at the extension of that, of the here and now. So we've become, you know, very good. For instance, it's become very, very important to be mindful, that is, to be in the here and now, not worried about the future. But, you know, that obviously is unbalanced. You know, mm-hmm. it's we need to be able to encompass the past, the future, and the here and now, and not be moved by it. But, we've become biased towards the here and now and the short term. And, you know, it makes sense. I can explain to people why mindfulness brings them closer to the present. But it's not a particularly good way of seeing the future so that you avoid the pitfalls. And so we become entrained too far one way. You know, it's like just in time manufacturing. It's, you know, we become entrained to being mindful and being present in the in the existence now. And so we completely forget about the future. So we're kind of like, you know, human beings are kind of unhinged. We all are. You know, we've got ourselves as far as we have, and that's good. But we need to further evolve and develop our ability to understand systems in a way that, you know, gets us to a point where we don't have to experience these unexpected tales to our previous decisions. You know, the outsourcing of manufacturing to another country eventually, common sense wise, anyone can tell you the common sense is that if you outsource 100% of your manufacturing, you're going to be pretty reliant on that rival to provide those services. And if that rival decides that they want to control your economy and control your democracy, well, then you really didn't foresee what your future circumstances were going to be. So, you know, I don't blame anyone. I think, you know, I think we spend too much time doing that. I think we just need to understand it.
So to drill down a little bit more into, let's say, understanding some of these systems, Craig, you know, oil obviously is getting a lot of the headlines as part of the Hormuz closure. But I think there's a more interesting story there to understand, or a more dramatic story there to understand. Products like naphtha, BTX, sulfur, and sulfuric acid are obviously another piece of the, let's say, molecule puzzle that is not coming out of the strait right now. So what are the, let's say, the downstream consequences of those products that need to be taken into consideration here?
I think firstly, we need to understand, people need to appreciate sequencing, right? So, you know, for instance, let's start at the top with this Hormuz stuff. You know, we all understand that 25% of LNG is impaired, and we understand that, you know, however million barrels a day of oil is impaired. But then the secondary petrochemical products come into it, you know, the naphtha, the sulfuric acid, the BTX, the various other things. And what do they do? Now, you know, they go into cycles of their own. For instance, you know, fertilizer's impaired, and there's, you know, four or five different types of fertilizer that do different things for your crop. You know, there's obviously stores of that. And so we're going to use those stores, and countries are, you know, will be planting in future planting cycles. And those impairments only become, I guess, come into our awareness once they happen. So, you know, we might be able to get a planting cycle away in Australia or another country now, but the next planting cycle becomes a difficulty. You know, there might be enough storage of naphtha, which is a petrochemical used in a variety of different respects, you know, everything from herbicide to pesticide, because it makes it sprayable, right through to a whole bunch of petrochemical and refinery processes. You know, that naphtha has to go into these specialized crackers that kind of heat it up, I think, to 800 degrees Celsius. And, you know, that has to go through the process. I think there's 44 million tons. Million tons is a lot. 44 million tons of naphtha that goes through Hormuz that gets into Asia somewhere, and that's right across Asia. I think there's about 11 million tons imported by China, and the rest is imported by the rest of Asia that needs to get into these furnaces called crackers. So that takes a while for the the message or the outcome of, you know, Hormuz being shut for 3 months or whatever it is now, to get into those things. Because if a cracker breaks, you know, closes down, and you just don't restart it and all that kind of stuff. So you have this kind of slow moving close down that nobody notices very much at the start, because there's stores and there's inventory and there's all kinds of things. And then everybody all of a sudden notices further down the track. And we haven't got a lot of visibility to how that's going to kind of emerge, because we've never had a slowdown before. So we don't monitor those things all that very well. You know, I get right in behind the filings of the companies that need these products, and they're already putting warnings in their SEC filings and their various filings to say, hey, this is a risk that we're not currently, you know, countenancing, but if it continues, well, then this, it could, you know, represent a risk to production in whatever company that we're talking about. And so, you know, it's kind of the queen, how long does it take the Queen Mary to stop once it has its engines in reverse? It takes, you know, 40 lengths of the ship or whatever it does. It's that kind of thing. It takes 40 lengths of the ship to slow down. So, you know, everybody's expecting immediacy, which is our kind of cultural belief. And, you know, when it doesn't happen, everybody goes, well, is it real? And, you know, that various stoppages may be way down the track. You know, for instance, the naphtha thing, you know, that's a huge input into manufacturing and plastics. And, you know, plastics are almost in everything that we manufacture. You know, you look at any, you know, sophisticated item that is being manufactured, plastics are in it. And there's other aspects that need to go into, you know, for instance, copper. You need sulfuric acid for copper, rare earths, a whole bunch of metals, because I think it's about 20%, 25% of the company of mining companies have an acid leach process at the start. And so that means they use sulfuric acid in the first process. Well, if that sulfuric acid is hard to get, you know, that obviously has an effect on the copper price, and it has an effect on the sulfuric acid price, and because they have to buy it in, and is it available? And everybody, you know, people point to those piles of sulfur in Canada and say, oh, we've got plenty of it, but you need special machinery to process it. You need special trains. Like, everybody sits, looks at that. I think everyone's seen those Canadian sulfur piles. And, you know, okay, we just have to go and pick it up. Well, you need special trains that manage the heat of the sulfur as you go. So you've got, you then go back to the carriage makers and go, okay, how many carriages can they build to produce a workaround for Hormuz? And, you know, they can only produce carriages at such a rate. And then you've got the furnaces that they need the sulfur to process by, and, you know, they've got a waiting time of 24 months and all this kind of stuff. So you've got confounding factors right through the process. And everybody knows this is quite important, you know, from the Iranian point of view and the Chinese point of view and the American point of view, and they're all trying to you know, I guess, thwart each other by, you know, the Americans are blockading the blockade and all this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, the clock's ticking. And nothing's getting solved, and so the problem gets worse. But the problem gets worse silently because we haven't seen the results yet. You know, we haven't seen the results of a season in Bangladesh or India where there's a low amount of fertilizer or there's not enough herbicide or anything like that. And so we can get into this pickle. It's like walking out into quicksand. You know, we can get into this quicksand. And we can feel really good in standing out in the middle, and, you know, then we have a realization that we're too far away from land, and we're in a bit of trouble. And so it doesn't fit our political cycles. It doesn't fit any of our cycles at all. And so, you know, for a just-in-time type mentality that we have in the world, that we haven't kind of shed yet, we have all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of realizations coming at us, you know, in 3, 6, 12 months that we didn't really expect. And, you know, that goes for climate as well. You know, this El Nino that's coming is, you know, like I said, you know, the water's heating up, the ocean's heating up much stronger than it's ever heated up. The cold blob in the North Atlantic that everyone's talk about, the AMOC blockage, you know, that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's very few people in the world that can really translate that into a meaningful, you know, set of sentences. What does that mean to us? What would happen if AMOC stopped? You know, people are starting to get interested. But the reality is that we've got some pretty big warning signs in front of us that we're going to have to navigate, and they're going to be awkward to navigate. That's all right. Everyone, you know, we've even got a culture that's a kind of anti-doom culture where, you know, where Tony Robbins told us all to be positive and think, you know, in very positive ways. And it's like, you know, the world, it's okay to think of unpositive things, and you can still be a robust person. You don't have to fall apart just because you've realized that we've got some, you know, issues to navigate in future. We can hear doomerism, we can hear risk, we can listen to difficult things, you know, and not fall apart. Now, we've got 10,000 generations before us, every one of us, who managed through much tougher times than we have and didn't fall apart. So it's, you know, it's not the end of the world, and if it is, let's enjoy it. It's you know, it's things, the challenges that we face are no different to the challenges that previous generation faced, and, you know, we're up for it, and it shouldn't depress us.
Well, to add to, let's say, the constraints of the Strait of Hormuz already being closed, now Iran has said that they're closing the Bab el Mandeb Strait as well. And when we couple that with the, I think, 80 plus days that the Strait of Hormuz has already been closed, despite many tweets to the contrary, is the market, do you think, responding appropriately to how these closures are going to affect the markets that are so dependent upon those products?
I think everyone knows that the market's not responding rationally. You know, it's just common sense, isn't it? You know, we've got a whole bunch of AI companies, what do they call them, the Mag 7, who are forecasting, you know, Goldilocks economy forever. You know, that's okay. Like, the world's not going to end if the market corrects. You know, I think there are more serious things to worry about than asset prices, to be honest with you, because I think they're inflated anyway. So, yes, I think the market will correct. It's just common sense that we will. Like, we haven't got enough copper or energy or materials to build things. You might have noticed that, Facebook, what do they call Meta now? Meta are building data centers in tents, you know. I guess no one ever thought of building a data center in a tent until we needed to build a data center in a tent. But they, you know, I guess you can air condition them, and a very sturdy industrial tent is probably well good enough, rather than the concrete building that we used to build. So, you know, some of it will adapt, other bits of it won't. You know, The central banking model that we had was very much an asset inflation central banking model. Let's inflate our assets and what Bernanke called the wealth effect, which means that if you get richer because your assets are worth more, you probably spend a bit of that money and on luxury goods and various other things. You know, if your house goes from 500,000 to 2 million, you know, it doesn't look that bad to borrow 50,000 to fix up the bathroom. You know, when you look at that at scale, you know, that's what we've effectively done. You know, the main consumption band, if you go back 30 years, was around the 50 to 60% percentile of earners. That consumption band has moved up into the top 90, top 15%. So all the consumers are rich people now versus the consumers used to be normal people before. That's obviously not a cycle that can go on forever. You know, if we want to reindustrialize, we asset prices have to suffer. And so the people who hold the assets will become less wealthy. You know, and as these situation becomes more, you know, because we've got aging demographics as well, you know, the tax receipts fall because, you know, there's less people working and there's less consumption, and, you know, the governments will be forced to kind of steal a bit more of your money somehow, whether it be, you know, capital gains taxes or whatever they come up with. You know, they're forced to survive as well, and so what you end up is asset prices the asset prices rises that we experienced in the last 20 years will become a thing of the past because we've got more important things to do. It's a new era. And so asset prices have to fail, don't they? They have to fall, you know. And there's a lot of people who will get poor in the process, and that's okay. You know, it's not the end of the world that your assets fall in price, especially a lot of the assets we've got an unweighted system. Our system has too many people being super wealthy versus people, you know, I guess the spread of the wealth isn't right. And I think we all know that intuitively. And that has to correct somehow. And that will correct somehow. It's always corrected historically when, you know, I don't think we've been at this kind of extreme ever in the past where it's like a you know, in the 1920s, they had the Gilded Age where people used to build follies and all the rich people were doing fantastic until the 1930s, and everybody wasn't doing as well as they were. That's just the corrective loop, isn't it?
So, Craig, what do you think this time, you know, when the rubber really hits the road here and the markets do really start to price in what's going on in the world, what do you think the consequences are for, let's say, the dollar and the bond market? You know, it seems to me that the playbook that has been used of borrowing from the future is going to be extended beyond anything that we've seen. So, you know, what do you think gets sacrificed first, the dollar or the bond market?
Well, I think the dollar is overvalued. And that's just a pragmatic view. If you're going to reindustrialize, you need a lower dollar. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think it means a weakness. I think the dollar is central to the denomination of international debt. So, you know, something like plus 50% of debt is denominated in dollars. So it's not going to go away. And then you look at all the other... you look at the other currencies; they're not going to do any better than the US anyway. At least that the US is trying to reindustrialize. The other ones are still stuck in their consumption loop to differing extents. You know, the dollar is changing the way, and so is the CNY, the renminbi. You know, it's becoming more important to transact than it is from a reserve currency status. and like everything evolves over time, and so the dollar will evolve over time too. These repos that they're designing with different various countries mean that, you know, the USD may replace a lot of local currencies. You know, they're doing that with the stable coins as well. You know, there's something like $40 billion dollars worth of stable coin holders in Nigeria. There's like $3.5 billion in Somalia. You know, if you want to hold an asset overseas and you come from Nigeria, one of the best ones is stable coins, because you can it goes across borders. It preserves you from your local government, so to speak. And there's a lot of as much as we deride the Western system, there's a lot of local governments or regional governments you wouldn't want to hold your money in. So, you know, I think the old system's going to get tested. You know, I think they're going to try and inflate their way out of it. I think the bond market will hold them to account to some extent. It has to. That's just common sense. But you know, are there alternatives? You know, I guess there's gold and silver and all those types of things. But you know, eventually, let's not be surprised if government tries to cut them off if they become too powerful as well. You know, the government's got the power to survive, and we forget about that a lot of the time. I think the USD is going to be around for a long, long time. We're not talking, a lot of the USD collapse narrative comes from this idea that we're going to move across, you know, do a baton change from one hegemony to another. You know, China's rising and America's falling, and that's the end of America, and China will rise and they'll replace. It doesn't work like that. It fits well into our kind of skulls that kind of conceptual narrative will unfold. But you know, you've got two countries with a lot of means to survive. You know, we may go through 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years of struggle, and we don't know who ends up becoming the ultimate winner, if there is any such thing. Even the concept of winning is probably nonsense. You know, my hope is that we all learn to get on, and that trying to choke each other out is self-evidently a silly idea from any major country's point of view. What I am concerned about, I'm less concerned for the Americas and the Chinas of the world than I am for the Bangladesh or the Indias of the world. You know, I think, you know, two solid military powers with strong economies and a lot of wealth may be able to navigate this a hell of a lot better than a Bangladesh or you know, one of the African countries and things like that. You know, it's no coincidence we saw a lot when I grew up in the 70s. We used to get all these, these big famines in Bangladesh and places like that. And you know, that was coincidental on, you know, energy issues as well. And you know, I think we might go back to that. You know, it was not kind of normalized. You know, save. You know, we used to have concerts and things like that to save the famine in wherever. And you know, that's part of our history. You know, maybe we go back to some of that, because you know, the reality is we can't supply the world the same way as it is, and we're kind of stuck. It's like both America and Iran have each other in check, and it's like a double check, every move that either of them make keeps the other one in check, and it keeps the whole world in check at the same time. And so yeah, there's no solid winners or losers. They counter each other. You know, like you said, they're going to block the other straight, and I'm sure the I'm sure the Israelis and the Americans will bomb the hell out of them. But, you know, that seems to have been, that seems to have less effect these days. You know, you seem to be able to bomb some the hell out of somebody, and then they pop their heads up and they survive. It's it doesn't seem to have the net effect that it might have once had. And, you know, that speaks to the ability of countries to dominate each other. You know, I wonder if it applies to Taiwan. Is it really possible to invade Taiwan with the amount of autonomous weapons and all those kind of things? Or, you know, there's this concept of the short war that comes up again and again in history. Everybody going into a war expects it to be short. You know, that's happened right through history. The expectation, you know, Putin went into Ukraine. He thought it was going to be a short war. You know, Trump went into Iran. He thought it was going to be a short war. They thought Vietnam was going to be a really, really short war. It was supposed to be only 15 days or something like that at the start. This concept of a short war has bitten us so many times. Yeah, people, I think the markets have got an expectation this is going to get solved in, you know, maybe not 15 days, but maybe 60 or 90 days. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're sitting here 10 years from now. And, you know, we're both a lot older, but we're still talking about the same damn thing. And although, it might have mutated a few different ways before then. So I think this expectation this is short term is one of the key issues that people aren't really facing properly.
Do you think that this time and these financial constraints also brings about more war and conflict between other nations, brings maybe more nations into this conflict, Craig, as you know, as we're trying to look forward?
Yeah, well, it's choose a partner, isn't it? You have to choose a partner.
Yeah.
You know? Choose your partners for the next dance. You know, you've got some Middle Eastern partners choosing the US, and you've got some Middle Eastern partners choosing China and Russia. Now, they may change dance partners halfway through. You know, you've got UAE who've got the swap lines now, and they've chosen the Americans and Israel. Saudi seems to want to sit on the fence and choose both, and that might be possible. I don't know. So, you know, I think what happens is we've got this demarcation that's going to settle around the world, where you're either on our side or their side. If you're on their side, you're the enemy. And, you know, that's true from both perspectives. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for conflict between everybody. Like, obviously, if there's only a certain amount of things on offer, like supplies and commodities and things like that, countries are going to do their best to procure them. Like, Australia has very low storage levels of diesel, but we've got a hell of a lot of other things, and so we've gone into a kind of barter system with Japan and Korea and Singapore, which says, well, if you want this from us, we need some diesel from you. Now, will that survive? Is it resilient? I don't know. We'll find it out as we go. But other countries aren't going to have those kind of options. And, you know, if climate accelerates at the same time, it's another confounding factor. Like, we keep expecting that the chessboard that we're playing is going to stay the same, and the reality is the chessboard keeps moving as well, and so we've got new pieces on the table and things that we didn't consider popping up all the time, because, you know, we've got two conjoined twins trying to choke each other out and trying to be creative at the same time. And, you know, they may be successful. A lot of this rhetoric that goes into a lot of these conversations, you know, you see it on the social medias where somebody says, well, China's going to win because of boom, boom, boom. Well, China's going to prevail because of whatever. And you get the same thing with the American supporters. And it's really just kind of cheer squads that goes with footy and sporting teams. It doesn't, you know, you may have a situation, we may have a situation where neither prevails, and each of these parties do a lot of damage to each other. It's very difficult to prevail. You know, China still imports $2.5 trillion worth of stuff a year. You know, they're not exactly independent. You know, you talk about the NAPFA and the BTX and the things like that. They're not independent of all this stuff. You know, we're solidly integrated global. We're a solidly integrated global economy, and you know, we may be able to pull ourselves out of that to some extent, but we can't pull ourselves out of it to a total extent. And so, you know, a lot of this might be delusional anyway. The China and the US go hard at it. And you know, they can't beat each other. And that's what, you know, Trump can't beat Iran, and Iran can't beat Trump. And, you know, we may just end up with a whole bunch of, you know, everybody's got each other in check and can't get out of check. You know, this kind of trap that we find ourselves in because we assume that we're going to have a short war, or we assume that we understand all the pieces on the table and all the variables, and, you know, we don't at all, because the other side's playing their game as well and they take those variables away.
Craig, do you think that this, you know, this time with this level of conflict, does this bring us to possibly a new monetary reserve asset basket?
It's got to, doesn't it? It's got, you know, like, it's got to be more founded in materials, whatever we want to call them, chemicals or metals or whatever. I just don't think we've got the ability to continue to inflate assets. You know, that's what made the USD so popular in the first place, is it offered, you know, strong asset markets, and that enticed a whole bunch of money toward it. You know, and you can't inflate assets forever, and you know, that cycle's ending. So, yeah, I think we end up with a completely different regime. I think the USD becomes less of a reserve currency. And I don't mean less of a reserve currency to stop doing that. I think it becomes it'll become more of a transactional economy, become more of an instantiated currency that is used in, you know, because to be frank, I don't think a lot of currencies, local country currencies, may survive. You know, it's quite difficult. So, you know, when I go back to my comments earlier, I think they'll evolve. CNY, you know, they're insisting you pay renminbi to buy any major metal now. It's like iron ore, copper, and you have to sell it to them at CNY as well. That's a transactional you know, reserve asset. It's not a reserve currency in the kind of traditional format, because people, you know, will start telling you, oh, you need the ability to, you know, you need to have an open market, you need to do this, and you need to do that. But they may not want all those bits. They may just go for the kind of the more simple tradable economy, economic currency model. And so everyone's expecting that model to be repeated. A lot of commentators go, well, they can't be a reserve currency because they don't do these five things. And maybe they don't want to do those five things anyway. Maybe they just want to use their power.
Yeah, I think ultimately what the currency debate ends up boiling down to is trust, right? And the ability of a country to create trust within its borders and beyond its borders for others to be able to have the confidence to transact in that currency is ultimately going to be what I think prevails, right?
Yeah. I think it's got to be something common sense like that. Like, it's going to be what it's going to be. And, you know, countries will choose what's in their best interests. You know, what's in their best interest between China and the US? Well, you know, I think it'd be different for different countries, but you've got to be able to transact. You've got to be able to get swap lines. You've got to be able to survive as a country. And so whatever partner that you choose at the dance is going to be chosen on those terms, on the ability for your country to be, you know, to flourish. And you can see this is happening, you know, in, I guess, in the southern South American economies. You can see that they're kind of moving towards a US base in most cases. You can see that with some of the Asian economies, like the Philippines and Australia, et cetera, are moving towards that block. And so you're seeing blocks move. Now, where that ends up, you know, it's a better person than me that can predict, because at the end of the day, we don't know the future. You know, I think it was the Saudi oil minister that said, you know, I've been silent right through this, because to be honest, I think that's the higher ethic, that to honestly say you don't know what's going to happen because you don't know what's going to happen is really one of the things I think I'd highlight, is that even the most learned people on these types of topics are struggling to understand what the outcomes are going to be. And so you've got a whole bunch of pundits who say, well, this is going to be the outcome, and they, you know, they change their mind every 2 weeks. I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can predict the future that well. All you can do is, you know, say these are the possible futures, and depending on what the players do will depend on what the outcomes are. And you can't predict the outcomes, because I think both, all these parties have a talent for digging their holes deeper, to kind of compete and compete and compete, you know, in this chess match where that neither of them have got an advantage, to the point where they both suffer themselves. You know, it's an old idea of primacy, you know, that goes with, you know, a human geopolitics, is, you know, this idea that there's going to be a glorious primacy in one country over another is something that is infected us forever, and probably naturally, because, you know, we did, and primacy was important. But we continue to do it. You know, the China's going to be trying to have primacy over the West. The West's going to try and have primacy over the China. And to be honest, I don't think either of them are capable of doing it. And I think that's the great delusion, that either side can win this. I think, you know, hopefully my ideal scenario is that they come to their senses at some point and stop trying to destroy each other. Because we're all humans. And, you know, I think this idea of exceptionalism gets in the road too. You know, Chinese exceptionalism, American exceptionalism, you know, things that we tell ourselves aren't always true, and they create weaknesses and incentives of their own. If you keep telling yourself you're an exceptionalist country, eventually we saw in Spain in the 16th century that, you know, they did exactly the same thing until they lay in ruin, so to speak. Most empires do. And so we've got a lot of that at the moment, and it's distracting to, you know, what's the real job at hand. You know, we've got very serious breakdowns in our systems, and we've got some very serious challenges to navigate. And, you know, we're focusing on who's going to win. And, you know, in my guess is that we're all going to lose, you know, to a significant thing. Like, the world follows these types of cycles. You know, to some extent, the the Old Testament was, that's what it was about. You know, the flood was metaphorical. The Tower of Babel was metaphorical. You know, they were talking about systems theory. They were talking about the natural cycle of systems. You know, you can fit the Old Testament like a glove over the Bronze Age collapse. They talked about civilizational stability since civilization began. I guess it's not surprising. And so we've had these times in history where our stability becomes fragile, and we need to work through that kind of stuff. And you know, we will. But I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be dramatic.
Craig, I think one of the biggest challenges at this time as well is the ability to find credible information. How do you try to find credible information to be able to trust or to be able to assemble these complex ideas?
It's bloody hard. because you've got confounding factors. They're all trying to make you think something else. You know, I try and construct my own reality, so to speak, from the facts I can find. I'm a good systems thinker, and I kind of see things a little more easily than most. And so I try and, you know, people say, what do you read? What books do you read? And all that kind of stuff. I don't really read that much. I try and, you know, construct things for other people so they can read what I'm reading, or what I'm thinking, because that seems to be valuable. So, you know, I think it is a tough era to navigate. But like I said, 1,000 generations before us did it. You know, we just need to focus on, you know, what's real to us and what our own needs are, and not necessarily believe what people are telling you, because, you know, at the moment what people are telling us, you know, the mainstream news, my wife is constantly going, well, how come this isn't on the news? And, you know, because the news hasn't got a great ability to absorb this kind of uncertainty. You know, what would they report in their defense? You know, they would report, well, there's a theory over here and there's a theory over there, and this is, you know, the mainstream news was only built to report stability, was only really built to to tell us, you know, that everything was kind of the same. It wasn't really told us, it wasn't really built. You know, everybody's got frustrations with mainstream news, but you know, our expectation has to match what their ability to tell us is. You know, they're going to tell us every different theory and every different system. You know, that they basically tell us what can be sold to us as consensus, and you know, that's pretty natural. So, you know, I try and wake everybody up to what I think needs to be thought about. But who's to say I'm right? You know, it's one of the, I go back to the Saudi oil minister. You know, like, he's one of the best oil guys in the business, and he can't work out what's going on. So you know, maybe we have to find a kind of middle ground where we go, well, I'm not sure what's going to go on. I'm not sure what's going to go on, and that's okay. You know, part of the big delusion of these days is we've got to have an opinion about things. And I don't think we need to have opinions about everything. I think we can say we're not sure. And I think we're going to get better at that as we go through. But, yeah, so I don't know. But, you know, there's some great commentators that, that are around at the moment. And, you know, I think what we need to do is find our own source of truth. But most of all, look after ourselves. You know, if things do get difficult, how are you going to feed yourself? You know, how are you going to look after your loved ones? That's what our ancestors did. I think that's pretty common sense that we do that in a thoughtful, non-panicking, non-depressive way. You know, like the idea that we have to be depressed about difficult times, I think we become better people when in difficult times. We look after each other better. We become realer rather than if, you know, the last era was all about, you know, our own perceptions of ourselves in the media and the social media and things like that. And, you know, maybe they're not as important. You know, our last era was all about identity, you know, rather than the collective. You know, our identity is important, but it's not going to help you navigate a collective challenge. It's not going to make you less fragile. It's going to make you more fragile. I think we've just got to become realer and more human.
Well, Craig, I think that's a great place to kind of put a pin in it for today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up?
No, just learn to enjoy yourself. Learn to be real. Grow things. Spend time with your family. You know, let's refine our ancestors' sense of community and collectivity, if that's a word. You know, the times might be tougher, but the times might be better, if that's possible. Not for everyone, but, you know, for a lot.
Well, Craig, I like I say, I really appreciate the time and work that you put into your writing. It's very, very interesting, very captivating, and something I think we need to take into account. And of course, that's all available on your Substack, the C. Tyndale Substack, of course, on X as well, at C. Tyndale, and on LinkedIn as well. Craig, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.